When I came into training to be a therapist, I had this notion that counsellors were these, they'd reached the holy grail of being emotionally sorted, you know, that they lived in these big posh houses, they had a lovely car, that nothing bad happened. It was just this underlying perception that if you're going to be giving out mental health advice, then you've got to be pretty sorted yourself, you know? I think that was something that started getting me followers, was me actually saying, that's rubbish.
Today I'm welcoming Samantha Lee, who many of you will know from her wonderful Facebook business page, Samantha Lee Counselling, and also her very popular CPD training on working with the inner child. Sam and I met a number of years ago now when we both rented rooms on a sessional basis for our private practices in Southend-on-Sea. And Sam later attended a face-to-face CPD, which I'd called Good Enough Counsellors. And she then decided to work with me as one of my coachees. I've checked my records and it looks like that was 2018. And the rest, as they say, is history. So Actually, I'm really delighted to have Samantha here. She is such a wonderful, wonderful counsellor. I'm so proud of the work that she's done. She's really, really blown me away with what she's managed to get done. It's really
proud of you,
Sam. You're
going to make me blush, Jo. Lucky no one can see me.
So welcome, Sam. You're very welcome on the show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I guess the first question I just wanted to ask you, if you can cast your mind back, is can you remember what you wanted to work on when we first started to work together?
I didn't even know what I wanted to work on. I wanted someone to tell me what to do. That's what I really remember, because I remember feeling so out of my depth. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was all this information that was coming at me from all different angles, and I really didn't know what to do, which was frustrating, because I have a professional background. I used to work in London for nearly 30 years as an event manager. I felt like I should know what I needed to do, and I kind of did, but I don't know, I think it just all this new stuff, this transition from being an employed person and someone paying me a job and telling me what to do, to going into a career where it was all unknown. Mm-hmm. It just was a trigger for, you know, that insecure part of me to come out, and I just felt really stupid. There was such a big pressure to be this accredited counsellor. If you didn't get towards accreditation, you were never going to get a job in counselling. And then the thought of, oh, well, maybe I'll go into private practice seemed to be equally daunting. It was like, God, you know, which one do I go for? Mm-hmm. And I did like the idea of working for myself. And I think I just needed somebody to be accountable to.
Yeah,
I think that was the thing that I loved about working with you, was that I've got this creative brain that goes off on a tangent about so many different things, and I find it really hard to complete tasks. You know, I come up with lots of ideas, but it can take me ages to keep moving towards the end, you know?
Yeah.
But because I knew that if I had you working with me, I had to kind of report back to the boss, you know, each month. He was like, well, I've got to do it. I've got to do it, because I was seeing Joe, plus the fact I was paying for it.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to get value for money.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was it. I just felt like I needed someone to guide me.
It's quite funny looking back on it, because actually you've done a most amazing growth since then, haven't you? So I think one of the things, the first thing we worked on was your business page, wasn't it? So tell people about your business page and what you've done with it and how you've made it work.
I started to do these posts that I thought were very professional and counsel-y. Oh my God, though, they were boring. Mm-hmm. And because I was doing what I thought I should do on the page, I didn't enjoy it. I found it really quite boring, and it was like a task. And then I don't know how long I did that for, possibly for the first year, but it just got more and more frustrating. And I don't even know what happened actually to make me start changing. But
I'll tell you what happened. One of the things that happened. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember. Yeah. It was, you know, we talked about this, didn't we? And one of the things that you said you did was that you wrote poetry.
Ah.
And you started to share your poems on your business page.
Was that really? God,
yeah,
do you know
what?
Yeah,
that was a real big part of it. Yeah.
I'd have completely forgotten that.
And I think there is a real, you know, but we can sort of think, oh, we've got to do it a particular way. You know, it's got to be what suits you. And one of the things you're really good at is when you write so brilliantly, it really connects with people, I think. And you share a lot of yourself, don't you? And that just connects with people. And you found what works for you, which I think is a really, really important sort of point to bring out of this conversation. But yeah, going back, you did start to share your poems, didn't you? I mean, tell people about your poems in case people don't know about them and what happened.
So I went through quite a prolonged phase, actually, where I just suddenly started to feel like I had something to say, but I didn't know how to say it. And there was so much happening in my professional and my personal life. And I just started to, I'd always liked writing poetry and reading rhyming stories as a kid. I used to like Dr. Seuss and things like that, you know, Green Eggs and Ham,
yeah,
showing my age
eggs,
there.
Yeah.
But I'd used to enjoy writing simple poems when I was at school. And I don't even know why I started doing it, but I just started to write my thoughts down about different things in rhyming stories. And some of them I'd show to family or friends, and they'd be like, oh my god, that's really good, how did you do that? And I'd be like, well, just wrote it, it just came into my head and I wrote it. Yeah, so I must have started to put them online, and then I was really surprised by the reactions that I started to get. And in fact, I read people's comments about my poems sometimes. And it's almost like I'm looking over my shoulder going, God, are they talking about me? Because they'll say such lovely stuff about how it's... I mean, I had a message not that long ago, actually, where somebody said that one of my poems had changed their life.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the story, but the fact is that they said that it really changed their life. And I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
You know, that's like... amazing.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing. And I don't know if you can remember what it was like when you first started sharing. Was it hard to begin to share them sort of like publicly, to put them on Facebook?
Well, no, I didn't feel like it was a big thing, because I don't suppose I had that many followers then. It's taken me a long, long time to build up my followers. And I will say this, I don't mean this to minimise anybody else's efforts, but I would say that I still only have just under 2,000 followers, because in the grand scheme of the internet, that's a tiny following, you know. There's, you know, because there's people that have got millions or hundreds of thousands of followers.
Yeah.
But actually, my little corner of this Facebook community, they're so lovely. They're so engaging. They, you know, they'll write a lot of comments and they'll do a lot of reactions and stuff.
Yeah.
And you see sometimes these people that have got the hundreds of thousands of followers, and actually they're getting no more of a percentage of people answering their stuff or commenting on their stuff than mine, if you know what I mean. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think it says something about the quality of what you're doing, actually. And I think that's, I know you're not one to sort of polish your halo, but you know, I think that's something for you to take credit for, in that, you know, I certainly love following you and reading your posts, and you know, they often speak to me, because I think the thing is, you're very honest, you're very real, aren't you? So tell people about how you tend to, what's your sort of writing process for your posts?
It's really just winging it half the time.
I was going to say that I should have qualified what the question actually, because I thought possibly when I said, what's your writing process? It makes you think, oh my God, you know, I should have a writing process. And that wasn't what I meant. Because, you know, I mean, obviously there's people who sort of, you know, do have a writing process where it's terribly organised and everything. But I don't think everybody thinks like that. I don't think everybody works like that. So how do you go about creating your post?
Okay, so it depends on if I've seen something that's resonated with me, mm-hmm. or if something has happened to me personally or professionally, and then I'll go from there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do like to be visual. I tend not to be that interested in posts where there isn't a good picture or a good meme to reflect what's going to be then written, because mm-hmm. if people are going to invest time in reading the thing, I think it needs to capture you. The picture needs to capture you. So I've got so many pictures and memes on my phone. I've actually mm-hmm. got to go through and get rid of half of them because my phone keeps telling me I'm running out of memory, and I don't want to pay bloody Apple any more money than I already do for storage. Yeah, what was the question? I've forgotten now.
It was just how you go about creating a post. So you'll find a meme or you'll find a picture or something that speaks to you, or you'll think about something that's happened to you and you'll find a picture that somehow expresses something around that. Would that be the case?
And I think somehow through the poetry, people began to realise that a lot of the stuff I was writing about, it wasn't just about things that had happened to other people. I was telling them that some of this stuff had been experienced by me. Yeah. And I guess some of the comments must have been that, oh, it's really nice to see that there's a counsellor that, you know, isn't perfect, or something along those lines.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, this is something that is really ridiculous. When I came into training to be a therapist, I had this notion that counsellors were they'd reached the holy grail of being emotionally sorted, you know?
Yeah.
That they lived in these big posh houses, they had a lovely car, that nothing bad happened. You know, I didn't have actively conscious thoughts about it, but it was just this underlying perception that if you're going to be giving out mental health advice, then you've got to be pretty sorted yourself, you know? And I think that was something that started getting me followers, was me actually saying, that's rubbish. It's because we've been through so much stuff ourselves that firstly we're attracted to counselling and helping people, because we know what it's like to go through experiences where we didn't get that help.
Yeah.
And that those things that have happened to us have had a lasting impact, and they are things that we still have to deal with on a regular basis in our lives. And I don't want my clients to be sitting there feeling intimidated by me because they think that I'm somehow better than them.
Yeah.
And so that was when I started to write more honest posts about, mm-hmm. look, this is me, this is what, you know, some of the stuff that I've experienced, this is what I have to do to cope with it. And, you know, whether you're a counsellor or not, we all have stuff that happens in our lives that sometimes means we need extra help.
Yeah.
And that really resonated with people.
That's it. Yeah. It takes you off the pedestal, doesn't it? You can actually meet them at where they're at because you yourself understand what it's like to be there. And I think that it gives people that connection that I think a lot of people are looking for.
And it's about getting the balance right as well. You know, you don't want to give away too much because mm-hmm. you don't want a client to then feel not confident that, you know, you can deal with their stuff. But, to be open enough to say, you know, I struggle with this stuff sometimes too.
But I think the thing that you do is you sort of put it in the context and you explain, don't you? So especially, I think, with your inner child type things, you'll talk about your feelings and how... Sometimes I see where you've done a little picture of yourself with the big glasses on from when you were a little girl, and you had those really sort of thick sort of bottle top glasses, and you talk about what it was like to be that little girl and how rejected you'd feel as that little girl, but how now you look after that little girl. So there's always sort of like, it's always put in the context of this is, it sort of includes psychoeducation really as well, doesn't it? It includes explaining to the client how you can work with those sorts of feelings and what you can do to make those sorts of feelings, to how to work with those feelings, how to make yourself feel better, how to look after yourself when you've got those sorts of feelings.
Because I see it so much on in everyday life with friends and family and on the counsellor groups, people that aren't always aware that the things they're struggling with are because a past part of them has been triggered, and they're feeling these same reactions and thoughts and beliefs that they once had as a child in their adult life, and it's really getting in their way of being that capable adult that they can be a lot of the time in the present day.
You know,
and that's something that I've learned, you know, ever since I went into counselling, that, oh my God, I've got in my own way so many times, I still do now, you know, and it's so frustrating because we could be doing so much more and we could be enjoying life so much more if we didn't always have this scared, confused, out of their depth little child inside of us that's going, oh my God, you know, for this podcast, it would be, oh my God, I can't do a business page. Oh my God, I can't do a website, or I can't do social media. I mean, how many times do you hear that? Oh, I can't do social media. It's just, we've got that little child inside of all of us to an extent, some of us a lot more than others, and, you know, depending on our pasts. But that part can really get in the way when it comes to building a private practice.
So I'd love to know a bit more, and I'm sure other people would like to know more, about your sort of inner child work and what got you interested in inner child and how you've developed your inner child work as a therapist.
Well, what got me into it was, I remember being in my training, I think it was probably from about level 3 onwards, there was just certain lessons that we had where it was actually not necessarily to do with the real deep inner child stuff, but just starting to talk about the parent adult child model in TA. And then kind of certain things started to come up for me about things that I'd experienced as a child. It just really resonated with me. I could really, that theory, TA, and then attachment theory, they really did seem to hit home for me. And then, you know, I started to become aware that there was this really, really vulnerable part of me that I hadn't really acknowledged, or acknowledged is the right word. I kind of felt that I had that part of me, but I'd not really paid it much attention. And the more that we did that kind of stuff in the studies and more reading and everything, the more I started to become interested in it. And then I found a supervisor when I'd qualified, who, Jeanette, she's passed away now, unfortunately, but I was with her for 7 years, and she taught me everything I knew up to that point about the inner child, because she introduced me to the two inner children that I have in me, because I have a younger little Sam who is aged anything from 4 years to say 10, 11. And then I've got this angry teen in me who really tries to stick up for me by shouting very loudly every time I go through things in life where I feel unheard or things are unjust, you know, unfair. And the placements that I started to get as a student, I was really lucky. Well, no, actually I wasn't lucky. I made them happen,
mm-hmm.
but I feel lucky that I experienced them is what I mean.
Yeah.
I started working with some incredibly vulnerable people. I worked with Women's Aid,
mm-hmm.
and I worked at Mind, who get a lot of people that have fallen through the gaps in the system,
yeah.
that really shouldn't be seeing student counsellors on a placement. But,
yeah.
You know, there was very little that I felt that I could do for them. But I just mm-hmm. kind of said, well, you know, in this 6 or 8 sessions that we've got, tell me what's happened to you, rather than, you know, don't tell me what's wrong mm-hmm. with you, you know, your label, because they would say, oh, I'm bipolar or whatever. I'd say,
yeah.
what's happened to you? You know,
mm-hmm.
tell me what's happened in your life. You'd start to see these little children that had just experienced so much.
Mm.
And then wondered why they weren't able to be a fully functioning adult. And then I worked with addiction. And then I worked with homeless people for a short while. And you just see in every area of life where people have these struggles, I could just find each time, tell me about what's happened to you. And it all starts when you're a child, and actually probably
yeah.
starts before them, because it's obviously it starts with your parents and how they were parented and how
yeah.
their parents were parented, and
yeah.
yeah, it goes on.
Yeah, that intergenerational.
And it just seemed to be a natural thing that I started to work with that all the
yeah.
time. It just seemed to happen.
And then what happened once you've been working for a while with your inner child?
So when I met you, that was kind of, I was working with lots of different clients, but I was still working from that perspective. And then obviously I'd started to get quite a lot of experience in that line of work. And then when I started to work with you and was kind of not, you know, you asked me about my ideal client, I think it kind of grew from there.
Yeah,
because my ideal client was professional people that you would look at, and in a similar vein that I've just described how I used to look at counsellors, you know, the
yeah.
kind of people that you look at their life and you think, oh, they're so lucky. They've got a lovely house. They've got a lovely family. They go on all these amazing holidays and everything. And you just think that they've got their life sorted. And yet when they come to see us,
mm-hmm.
you can see that doesn't matter where you are in life, you can still have this seemingly wonderful life, but if you open up that closed door, it's not what it seems, is it?
Yeah. Well, quite a lot with men, don't you? I think that's sort of one of the areas where you do a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, it's interestingly, that is still my ideal client. I do love to work with men. I think since the inner child stuff really took off, I've probably lost track a little bit of my marketing, in that I tend to now attract a lot of counsellors.
Yeah, because they want
to clients.
Because I just want to move on and say that you then started some training, didn't you, on the inner child?
Well, and I would never have done that without you, Joe. That was your idea. I'm going to give that one to you, because I would never have even had the confidence to suggest it. It was something that I'd often think about when I was in London and I'd go on a training course and I'd think, what a great job. I'd love to do that. And then I don't even know if I maybe mentioned that to you, but you saying, why don't you do a training course on the inner child? That was just hilarious to me at first. I don't know if you remember that. I was like, don't be ridiculous.
Yeah, there was a lot to work through in a sense, wasn't there? Because again, it's that sort of, you know, I've got to be some sort of expert. I've got, you know, I'm not like an academic.
Yeah.
There was all that sort of stuff, wasn't there? But the result is that you've written something from your heart, really, haven't you, that can again...
I just do it in... Yeah, because you recommended that I try experiential training.
Yeah.
And that was a new thing for me. And it's really interesting. I feel like I've kind of come full circle now, because I've just been doing this very... lofty academic course by, is it NIACB or something?
Oh, yeah. Whatever they are. Yeah.
Yeah, real big trauma names, Pat Ogden and people like that that are there. And they are talking about the work that I do on a weekly basis, but they just use different big fancy words to explain what I do, you know. And it was real like validation watching this latest course, because I was like, oh my god, I already do that. You know, my old supervisor Jeanette used to say to me, you don't need all of this training, Sam, you're good enough already. And in a way she was right, because but also we do need to keep current, so we do need to keep doing some training with our CPD. But yeah, it was really validating to listen to all these amazing people that I hold in real high esteem, but what they were saying was nothing new to me. It was like, well, I kind of say that in my courses anyway, but I just say it in a different way that's more layman's terms, I suppose.
So I just for any of our listeners, you can get a much better course and much less price if you get Sam's course. I have to say, I haven't actually completed Sam's course myself, but I did get a little sneaky peek when she first brought it out and she sent me over some of it, and I was absolutely blown away by it, because I think the thing that you do so, so well is you get people to really think about what is going on inside them, and what they're in, who their inner child is, and how their inner child is responding. And so, I mean, I don't know what sort of feedback you get, but I would imagine that a lot of it is people are really, really touched. You know, it's a real sort of like personal development thing, as well as learning how to work with inner child with clients, isn't it? Because it's really about, you need to like look after your own inner child and do the work, in a sense, before you can really do it with the clients. Is that, would that be true to say that?
Yeah, I would say that everything that I put into my courses is trying to replicate the same things that I have gone through and done for myself, and then the same things that I've then passed on to clients, and then seen how they've grown and developed by using the same techniques. Although some of my courses, I'm definitely saying this happened to me. There's a lot of other stuff that I talk about where I'm not naming clients or saying, you know, this happened to a client, but it's the experience of working with those clients, because of how I've experienced it too, that I can then give more examples of how the inner child plays out in different experiences.
So it's sort of like a whole amalgamation of what you've learned through your career and through working with lots of different people.
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to have lived exactly the same experiences, but just being able to connect to that part of you, and then to be able to see how it influences you on a daily basis, that's when you can really start tapping into and spotting the inner child in your own clients. So that's why it's a really important thing to do the course and experience your own reactions to what I bring up in the courses, because then if you really pay attention to how you're feeling, you will really get to know your own inner child, and in doing so, that's when you can start to see how it's playing out in other people. You will start to look at everybody around you, and you will see all these wounded little kids. I mean, I look at Donald Trump, and all I see is a little wounded boy, and one that kind of sees the world as, or approaches the world with, dinner, I don't care, it's not my fault. You know, it just is like this little boy. I find it amazing. I see that in a lot of politicians, actually. All these little kiddies. But it's a great way to work.
So something else that I remembered when I was getting ready for this interview is something that happened to you during COVID. And I can't remember, I don't know if you'll remember this. So you've got your business page, And you went off to get vaccinated, didn't you? Do you remember what happened? You told me about it.
Oh, my God, yeah. That was so funny. I had this nurse call me over for my injection. And she went, oh, my God. She went, you're that counsellor, Samantha Lee, aren't you? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, this isn't one of my clients. How does she know? And I went, how do you know that? And she went, oh, my God. She went, I follow you on Facebook. She said, oh, you wrote that poem, and then insert name of whatever poem it was.
Yeah.
And she said, oh, and she said, it really resonated with me. She said, and I'm a fan. She said, I can't believe you're here. And I was thinking, I can't believe I'm having a COVID jab, and this woman's saying she knows who I am. It was bizarre. I mean, that's kind of the only time I've ever had an inkling what it's like to maybe be a celebrity, but it was funny. That does stick in my mind. So thanks for reminding me of that. It's a nice memory.
Yeah. It's just funny, isn't it? Because I think we've been sort of like, we've known each other for such a long time, and I have sort of like these little snapshots of things that have happened to you that you've told me about as you've gone along. Do you want to tell people about your mic? Because we were talking about your mic just before we started recording.
Oh, my little snowball microphone. I remember when I was about to do my first training course and I needed to get, or I wanted to get, a decent microphone, but they were quite pricey for my limited earnings at the time. Anyway, I bought a lottery ticket, and the lottery ticket came up. I mean, don't get me wrong, I haven't won millions, guys. I think I won £75, something like that. And it enabled me to buy my microphone, and I'm still using it today. It's sitting in front of me now.
It's brilliant. I think that, I mean, for me, that was just such a lovely thing to happen, because it came along at exactly the right time you needed it, didn't it?
It did. The universe provided.
And I don't think, you know, I don't want the interview to end without thinking about what it's been like for you. It sort of sounds, when you look back on it, it makes it sound as though it was easy for you. You know, it was easy for you to publish your poetry. It was easy for you to do your inner child workshop. You know, it's been easy for you to do your page. But I know that's not been the case, has it?
No.
It hasn't been particularly easy. And I just wonder if you could tell us a bit about, maybe about your process, sort of what tends to happen, what you go through when you're facing doing something new, and how you look after yourself in those situations.
When I'm facing something new, I try and put it off for as long as I possibly can, because that's what adults do, isn't it? I keep procrastinating and giving myself all the reasons why I can't do something. But then something that a very good business coach called Josephine told me was to do it in little steps, because that's how I started. I'd qualified and I had started seeing my one private client, and I just started doing every single step that there is to do with building your business. It took me years. You know, there's so many different things that when you look at the final result, it seems like it's been arrived at easily. But when you break it down, it's a bit like my old job of event planning. You see the final event and you don't appreciate just how much work goes into that event, you know, making that event happen. And it's the same with building a private practice. It's so many different stages of so many different elements, and they need to be worked through in a way that is manageable for you. Because I was a single mum. I was working part-time in London. I had a toddler and I had various different relationships going car crashingly wrong. And, you know, there was a lot going on, put it that way.
Yeah.
So it didn't happen quickly, you know. There was lots of different projects that took so long. I mean, that first course that I did, that took me nearly a year. And the amount of times that I felt like giving up, again, that's why I loved having you. Because if I didn't have you, I would have given up. because it would have just felt too hard. But you kept encouraging me to keep going back to the basics and just doing one little bit at a time. That was so helpful. And you sort of were like my cheerleader. You know, you can do it. You can do it.
And you have done it. That's the thing.
Yeah, you definitely gave me that belief that I could do it. So that really helped. You know, I see so many comments on the Facebook counselling groups of people that are frustrated by, you know, I've done all the directories and I've done this and I've done that and I'm still not getting inquiries. Oh my God, it just takes such a long time. You know, I've been doing this 10 years now and I'm a baby compared to a lot of other therapists out there that have been doing it longer. But each different stage, it takes time. And so I would always, always recommend now in hindsight that every single therapist is encouraged to keep their other job for as long as possible, because it will help you to, A, not get burnt out by trying to juggle everything all at once, because you know that you've got money coming in. It will help you to pay for things like CPD that you need to build up your experience and your knowledge. It will help you pay for a business coach if you want one. You know, you can maybe save up for that gradually so that you can eventually afford to have a business coach. It's, you know, you can, if you've got another job, plan for these things. You can take the pressure off yourself to be constantly worrying about where's my money coming from. Keep your other job. Honestly, it's self-care. I'll go off on a rant on that if I'm not careful.
It's okay, Sam, because I think the other thing that's happened is that for a long time that we worked together, you know, you were doing other work, weren't you?
Yeah.
You were working with other clients sort of in a paid capacity and employed capacity. And then you developed your course. And the developing the course and the private practice now means that you're able to, you know, you are fully self-employed, but you've got that other sort of second income coming in that sustains you as well, haven't you? So that sort of, it's also, it's a way of you being creative too, isn't it? That it gives you another sort of outlet.
And I would say, when Joe, you say that I'm fully self-employed, I want to clarify that to a lot of people that also think that that might mean I work full-time as a therapist.
Yeah,
I don't.
Me
saying I'm fully booked usually means, depending on what's going on in my life, usually means that my maximum would be I'm working with 10 clients a week. And the thing is, I can afford to do that now. And I actually am on a lot less than that at the moment because of things that have happened lately. You know, that's the other pressure that a lot of therapists feel, is that they've got to be working with, you know, 20 clients a week, 25 clients a week. And I would say that a successful private practice is one that you can adapt to your needs over time. I've had a successful private practice for a long time before I was fully self-employed, because what was successful about it was that I still had clients, not a lot of clients, but I was doing it on my own. You know, but I wasn't doing it as my only job. But now when I look back, it was a success. It suited my needs at the time. I couldn't be full time because I had a toddler, as a single parent. I got support from Universal Credit, so I was very lucky there to have that support. But yeah, you've got to adapt your private practice to what's going to work for you. So if you've got young kids and you need, well, everybody needs to pay their bills. So don't think that you're failing if you're not doing your private practice as a full-time thing and you've still got your other job. You're still a successful therapist and you will grow in your experience and your reputation while you've still got another job. That's still going to be happening. It doesn't have to be that you're only successful if you do it full-time and you're working full-time. Don't get me wrong, though. Being self-employed, you have to do some strong boundaries, because it's easy to be working outside of hours because you've got that little phone in your hand and those little notifications going off on your social media pages, and you're just going to have a look instead of watching a TV show and relaxing.
Yeah, absolutely. guilty as charged.
Yeah, I know. But then, it you is, know, yeah. it's your baby, so you do want to nurture
it. Yeah. So what do you do then to sort of try and keep yourself, you know, to give yourself self-care?
Right. So the past 18 months, I have gone through a huge amount of stuff. Me and my child had a car crash. They started college. There were different life events that were happening that were quite challenging. My mum had dementia and gradually her health was failing, and we eventually lost her in February. And I really had to scale down my practice over that time. And the only way that I managed was because I was selling my courses still. So in order to manage all of those things, I did have to stop marketing so heavily on my page and change the way that I was talking about stuff so that people weren't constantly asking if I could see them. I mean, I really had to take that time to look out for me, to make sure that I was okay. You know, I went back to therapy. I started doing transformational breathing, tried to exercise more. Didn't always happen, must admit. I just really tuned into me and what I needed so that I could then be okay for the other people in my life that needed help too. Yeah. And yeah, it's because I'd over time built this business that wasn't just client work. I'd built these courses, and they give me, again, don't get me wrong, I am not a wealthy person. These courses provide me with an average income, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something that's kept me ticking over while I've not been able to work as much. And that's something that I'll always be grateful to you for, Jo, because if I hadn't have done that, I don't actually know what I'd have been doing. If I'd have relied solely on client work, I think this is something that we can also be in danger of doing as therapists. And again, it's the influence of the child in us that has this magical thinking that, you know, we take on all of this client work, not really acknowledging what would happen if something were to happen to me or my family and I can't work, because you're your business. And so if something happens to you, where's your business? Where's your money coming in? If you haven't made adult arrangements to cover that in terms of, have I got a job that's going to pay me sick pay? You know, and the other job, will that pay me sick pay to help pay the bills? Or have I got insurance to help if I can't work for a while? Or have I got another means of earning money in my practice? So that is self-care. You know, acknowledging your limitations and still being able to pay the bills when things are hard.
Thank you. It's certainly given, I think, probably give people a lot of food for thought, actually, especially, you know, this sort of idea of, you know, a successful private practice is a full-time thing and it's having lots of clients. And yet, you know, what you're saying is you can be successful, but you can also be successful by making sure that you're looking after yourself and keeping an eye for other ways of looking after yourself.
Definitely. You know, because that's the thing that we're trying to model to our clients all the time, isn't it? Put yourself first and build this relationship with you. You know, because once you have this is the lovely thing about inner child work, is when you do eventually have this strong connection to those wounded parts of you that can still be triggered in the now, you're going to be your number one fan. You know, when I was vulnerable, you were my number one fan that kept me going. But in life, you can't always have a coach that's going to do that for you. You can't always have other people around to do it for you. So if you learn to love yourself enough that you can be your number one fan, then for a lot of times in life when things are vulnerable and going tits up, so to speak, then, you know, you'll be able to manage it a lot better because you'll care about what happens to you. this thought of, oh, you know, I can do all of these clients and I can do extra hours to do all the marketing and my admin and do my tax return and everything. Yeah, you can do it, but you'll probably end up being a frazzled wreck after a while. And I'll be the first to admit that I got very near to burnout before, mm-hmm. oh, what? Well, probably about a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Because we love this job and it's hard to not do this job when you get a lot of pleasure out of it. But
yeah,
you still have to make sure that you're doing stuff that makes sure that you're okay.
Yeah.
And we can lose sight of that sometimes.
Actually. I was going to say, you haven't mentioned you're walking.
I'm walking. Yes. Well, that's something that I haven't had to pay for. I did a walking challenge back in 2017. I wanted to be fit when I got to be 50. And ever since then, I've continued it. But during the week, I try to go out, and even if it's just 20 minutes around the block, just to have a mindful 20 minutes where I'm not sitting there thinking about work or all the other stuff that life throws at you. I'm just looking at the clouds and the sunlight and the flowers growing out of cracks and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just a really great way of keeping my mind healthy. And even that was very difficult in the last 18 months. You know, the inner child in me that was very much told what to do as a youngster rebelled against going out for exercise and wanted to just sit and watch the telly and eat chocolate. And I had to do a lot of work in reassuring that child that she can stay at home and watch the telly and eat chocolate while I go out and do my walk. You know, it might sound silly, but when you've got the awareness of how your inner child can get in your way, my inner child can get in my way when it comes to looking after myself physically.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like, she's going, I don't want to go on a stupid walk, you know, but I'm going, I really want to go on the walk. I want to get outside. Yeah. But it's amazing how she can just take over and be like, nope, we're not going. We're going to watch Netflix for 2 hours. And a lot of the last 18 months, she's won.
Yeah. I've got a feeling that this might lead to your next course. Your next mini course could be a mini course on the inner child and self-care.
There you go. You might have just planted another idea for me, Jo. I'll have to start paying your commission.
we'll put the podcast out and people will start saying, yeah, I'd really love to do that. So if you'd like to do that, folks who are listening, let Sam know.
Yes, all ideas.
We probably will do it.
Send me all your ideas.
Oh, Sam, it's been lovely to catch up with you and find out what's happening. And just there's so much there for people, I think, to think about. Quite challenging stuff as well for people to think about too, about how to look after themselves and how to make sure that, you know, this is a... I think we can be quite short-term sometimes about our private practices. Yeah, let's fill it up without sort of thinking, well, actually, you know, how do I want to be in 10 years' time or 15 years' time or 20 years' time in terms of my private practice? And to hold on to it for the longer term, we do need to sort of think about how we're going to manage ourselves. And different people do it different ways, but, you know, you found the way that works for you, which is fantastic. So...
And if they find that they're thinking, oh, well, it's all right for you, and, you know, getting some grouchy thoughts about me saying, you know, this is what you need to do, then that's your inner child getting in your way again. Because they don't want to be told what to do, maybe.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Oh, that's great. So people can find you at Samantha Lee Counselling.
On Facebook,
On Facebook, yeah. And they can find you at your website, Counselling for Essex. Your course is Me, Myself, I, and I will put the details in the show notes so that people can click through and find you.
Lovely.
So that they can follow you up. But I'm sure a lot of people will know you already. But
I always love to get new followers. So come and see me in my little corner. I'd love to see you.
Yeah, and I can thoroughly recommend following Sam because I love following her. So, you know, I often recommend you actually when people say, oh, I don't know how to do social media. Well, go and take a look at what Sam is doing. So.
Oh, thanks, Jo.
Yeah, so thank you. Thanks for coming.
You're welcome. Cheers.
Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.